Good morning. This is Bob reading the April 27th edition of the Herald and Review. We'll go to the front page articles. Number one, Trump claims victory, Clinton near nomination. In a front runner's rout, Republican Donald Trump roared to victory in five contests across the Northeast and confidently declared himself the GOP's presumptive nominee. Hillary Clinton was dominant in four Democratic races and now is 90% of the way to the number needed to claim her own nomination. Trump's and Clinton's wins propelled them ever closer to a general election showdown. Still, Sanders and Republicans Ted Cruz and John Kasich vowed to keep running, even as opportunities to topple the leaders dwindle. Trump still must negotiate a narrow path to keep from falling short of the delegates needed to claim the nomination before the Republican National Convention in July. Cruz and Kasich are working towards that result, which would leave Trump open to a floor fight in which delegates could turn to someone else. Trump was having none of that. It's over, as far as I'm concerned, he declared at his victory rally in the lobby of Trump Tower in New York. With Clinton's four victories, she ceded only Rhode Island to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. She now has 90% of the delegates she needs to become the first woman nominated by a major party. Clinton kept her focus firmly on the general election as she spoke to supporters Tuesday night, urging Sanders' loyal supporters to help her unify the Democratic Party and reaching out to GOP voters who may be unhappy with their party's options. If you are a Democrat, an independent, or a thoughtful Republican, you know that their approach is not going to build an America where we increase opportunity or decrease inequality, Clinton said of the GOP candidates. She spoke in Philadelphia, where Democrats will gather in July for their nominating convention. Sanders, in an interview with Associated Press, conceded that he has a very narrow path and we're going to have to win some big victories. Trump's victories in Maryland, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Delaware, and Rhode Island were overwhelming, winning his closest race by just about 30 points. The businessman is the only candidate left in the three-person race who would possibly clinch the nomination through the regular voting process. Yet he could still fall short of the 1,237 delegates he needs. Cruz and Kasich are desperately trying to keep Trump from the magic number and push the race to a convention fight. The Texas Senator and Ohio Governor even took the rare stop of announcing plans to coordinate in upcoming contests to try to minimize Trump's delegate totals. That effort did little to stop Trump from a big showing in the Northeast, where he picked up at least 10% of the 105 of the 100 delegates up for grabs. Despite his solid win in Pennsylvania, the state's primary system means 54 of the delegates elected by voters will be free agents in the GOP convention, able to vote for the candidate of their choice. Cruz spent Tuesday in Indiana, which votes next week. Indiana is one of Cruz's last best chances to slow Trump, and Kasich program is pulling out of the state to give him a better opportunity to do so. Tonight, this campaign moves back to more favorable terrain, Cruz said during an evening rally in Knightstown, Indiana. The event was held at the Hoosier Gym, where some scenes were filmed for the 1986 movie Hoosiers, about a small-town Indiana basketball team that wins the state championship. Trump has rallied against his rival's coordination, panning it as a faulty deal, and has also cast efforts to push the nomination fight. Yet there's no doubt the GOP is deeply divided by his candidacy. In Pennsylvania, exit polls showed nearly 4 in 10 GOP voters said they would be excited by Trump becoming president, but the prospect of the real estate mogul in the White House scared a quarter of those who cast ballots in the state's Republican primary. In another potential general election warning sign for Republicans, 6 in 10 GOP voters in Pennsylvania and the Republican campaign has divided the party, a sharp contrast to the 7 in 10 Democratic voters in the state who said the state between Clinton and Sanders has energized their party. The exit polls were conducted by Edison Research for the Associated Press and Television Networks. Democratic award delegates proportionally, which allowed Clinton to maintain her lead over Sanders even as he rattled off a string of wins in recent contests. According to the GOP count, Clinton has 2,089 delegates. Sanders has 1,248. Now we'll read an article from Decatur. The Macon County's GOP budget guru, Keith Ashby, resigns. Macon County officials will head into a fall of budgetary uncertainty without one of the more formidable fiscal minds. Keith Ashby, Republican Decatur, submitted his resignation last week to County Board Chairman Kevin Greenfield, effective immediately. It is with real sadness that I submit this resignation. I have enjoyed my tenure on the county board and believe the county board is an integral part of our community, Ashby said in his resignation letter. First elected to the board in fall of 2006, Ashby quickly became a go-to on the Republican side in regard to financial matters. He has been vice chairman of the county's Finance Committee in 2008 and was appointed the committee's chairman 2 years ago. He led the committee, which oversees how the county departments spend their money and prepares the annual budget, until 2014, when he returned to his previous role as vice chairman of the committee. Ashby also served as vice chairman of the full county board from 2012 to 2014. Where he once was a constant figure on the board and its commissions, Ashby cited a recent inability to attend meetings on a regular basis as part of the reason for his resignation. Greenfield said the move was not a surprise, as Ashby has been in the process of moving to Florida in recent months. In addition, Ashby has chosen not to seek re-election this fall. With some concerns about more cuts throughout the county and even the potential for layoffs, Greenfield said Ashby's mind for finance will be a loss for the county. His financial expertise will be missed. There will be no question about that, Greenfield said. I wish him all the best in Florida and the best of health. The county chairman now has 60 days to appoint or replace the rest of Ashby's term, which runs until the end of November. A board member will also need to be appointed to replace Ashby on the Finance Committee. Those 60 days look to be unnecessary, as Greenfield said Tuesday morning that he will likely appoint Deborah Kraft, president of Blackland Transport, in Blue Mound, to fill the rest of Ashby's term. As Kraft is on the November ballot to fill Ashby's seat in Board District 5, Greenfield said it was a logical choice. Appointment of Ashby's replacement on the county board and the finance committee is expected to occur at the county's May 12th meeting. Our next article this morning, also from Decatur, Ingram returns home as new MacArthur principal. Cordell Ingram has stayed Mac and proud for the past 21 years. Now the educator will get a chance to lead the school that gave him so much. Ingram, who currently serves as principal at Robertson Charter School, was appointed Tuesday night during the Decatur School District's board meeting as the new principal at MacArthur High School. Ingram and the school have a long history together, with Ingram having previously served as a math teacher and as head football coach. In addition, his children attended the school. I want to thank the board for trusting me with one of the prized possessions in this city, Ingram said. I've been a general for 21 years as a coach, a teacher, a parent, and a fan. Tonight I fulfill a dream of mine to be the principal of this great school. The decision was unopposed by the Decatur School Board, with 6 yes votes and only board member Brian Hodges abstaining. Ingram will replace Paul Renstead, who will be reassigned into an administrative position. Ingram, who will start on July 1st, will have a base salary of $136,283. Superintendent Lisa Taylor said after the meeting that Ingram's passion for the school was palpable and would serve him well in the role. He's a great choice. He's a very passionate about this job, Taylor said. In other business, the board received good news as they learned that the state funding for the adult education program has been approved by lawmakers and signed by the governor Monday. The program is currently suspended due to a lack of state funds, but Taylor said several classes were still going on and a full-time director and secretary are still in place. This board is likely to move forward on lifting the suspension and reestablishing the program at its next meeting, Taylor said. One topic conspicuously absent during the two-hour meeting was any discussion or reference to last week's announcement that Taylor had accepted a principal position next school year in Hayworth. There were no public comments on the topic, and Taylor did not address it during the post-meeting comments. What direction the board will go to replace her also remains in question, as board president Sherry Perkins did not speak to reporters as she made her way out of the board meeting. The next article from Iliopolis, the tragic memories of the former Formosa plastic plant. Green grass waves in the wind where once stood 36 acres of steel pipe, tanks, and concrete that made up the Formosa Plastics Corporation, USA Chemical Works. Pretty much every last trace of the plant has been cleared away, but the explosion and fire that doomed it on the night of April 24, 2004, and took the lives of 5 of its 138 workers left tragic memories that will forever haunt Central Illinois. New Jersey-based Formosa had bought the plant in 2002 from a company formerly known as Borden Chemical Inc., which had operated for years. Both companies were folded in a later. Both companies were folded in a later investigation into the disaster. Formosa was criticized for failing to make equipment and procedure changes that might have prevented a worker opening a valve and triggering the explosion. And the accident investigators, the U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, said Borden had also been aware of the plant dangers that could lead to the accident, but had taken no action. The result was an employee on cleaning duty became confused and opened the wrong valve on a 30-foot-tall chemical reaction vessel that produced polyvinyl chloride, a key ingredient in many plastic products. More than 17,000 pounds of vinyl chloride gushed out, turning instantly from a liquid to a flammable gas cloud. Alarms blared out, but workers on the scene who could have fled stayed at their posts and tried to slow the chemical release. The volatile cloud detonated at 10:40 p.m., causing the massive explosion and fire. Killed in the incident were Joseph Machalek, 50, Larry Graves, 47, and Linda Hancock, 56, all of Decatur, and Glenn Lyman, 49, of Cornland. Hancock's husband, Randy Hancock, 50, died in a hospital burn unit 3 weeks later. The worker whose actions triggered the blast was among those killed, but investigators did not reveal their identity. Three other employees suffered serious injuries, and the disaster prompted the evacuation of 150 residents from Iliopolis to safeguard them from the risk of toxic smoke and fumes. There had been talk in the wake of the accident of Formosa rebuilding or reestablishing a new production unit on the site. "We have a commitment to the site and plan to have some type of facility there," a company spokesman told the Herald and Review as late as October 2006. But it never came. The Herald and Review tried to reach a Formosa spokesman, but no one was available for comment. As for the village of Iliopolis, officials would like to see the chemical plant site redeveloped. The next article is an article on an editorial, "Our Views, Decatur Board Must Regain Public Trust." The situation between Decatur School Superintendent Lisa Carver Taylor and the school board came to the best conclusion possible last week when it was announced that she has accepted a position as junior-senior high school principal in Hayworth. Taylor will be missed by many in Decatur, but when the board made it clear they weren't all happy with Taylor, the best solution was to move on. The board indicated to Taylor at a closed meeting in February that four members were against extending her contract when it expired in July 2017. When word of that discussion became public, there was a massive show of support for Taylor, and the support subject has dominated the school board meetings since that time. We fully expect that Taylor will be successful in Hayworth and anywhere else she goes in her career. Taylor is a likable, capable administrator. Her commitment to collaboration and collective ownership has led to many accomplishments in Decatur schools during her career. Taylor's commitment to "we" instead of "I" is outstanding. The situation does leave some challenges for the board, both within the board and with the community at large. Four board members, President Sherry Perkins, Vice President Barry A. Butts, Alita Graham, and T.J. Jackson, were against extending Taylor's contract. The other three members, Dan Oakes, Brian Hodges, and Fred Spanis, spoke in her favor. The board needs to find a way to work through the issues that are on the horizon. The board also needs to work on its relationship with the community. Many community members were not only upset by the Taylor decision, but were also upset by the way it was handled by some board members. Although personnel information can't be discussed freely, it's fair to say that the board did not communicate well. The Decatur community has been supportive of its schools for years, emotionally and financially. However, many felt that support wasn't acknowledged during the Taylor discussions. The desire of the students, staff, and community were not sufficiently considered in the Taylor decision. The good news is that Decatur residents have shown they have a lot of interest in their schools, and the board should look for ways to involve those interested citizens. Perkins said in a statement issued later in the same day that the Taylor announcement was made in the District 61 has some issues on our plate. "We will focus our energy to address these issues. Ultimately, we are supportive of the development of our students in our community and want to continue moving the district forward. A crucial step in moving the district forward will be the process of selecting a new superintendent. One way that the board can begin to heal its relationship with the community is to make that process as open and transparent as possible. Although the new superintendent will report directly to the board, the best outcome for District 61 is if the entire community feels a part of the hiring process. The next article, Rose makes it up to Evergreen. Decatur. Shap and Rose walked up to a table in the luncheon room at Evergreen Place Supportive Living on Tuesday and shook hands with resident Betty Hall. "You need to lose some weight," Hall told Rose, the state senator from the 51st District. Rose smiled at Hall and said, "I'm working on it." Rose has been working on a lot lately as part of the Illinois General Assembly as it tries to end a 2016 budget impasse, and that is 10 months past the deadline. With the legislature in session, plus a slew of college students and administrators in Springfield trying to get MAP grants and other funds released to universities on April 13th, Rose missed a meeting with several people from Evergreen who were there with the Affordable Assisted Living Coalition. Evergreen Community Relations Coordinator Dana Sharp, Life Enrichment Director Pam Workman, and five residents waited 45 minutes, but Rose never showed. Sharp said they were disappointed, but understood a senator's time is limited. She was surprised when Rose's chief of staff, Landon Stringer, called Evergreen the next day and set up a visit. "Session days are crazy. Whatever schedule you had the night before is changed by 8:15," Rose said. "To me, the most important role in Springfield are the ones who come from back home to visit, so I try to see them. But with the schedule being so hectic, you invariably miss somebody. The thing is, even if we had met, it would have been difficult for it to be a quality conversation because you're getting pulled away for a committee hearing on a budget or a budget meeting. So when I'm out of session, I enjoy coming to the locations, walking around, meeting people, and getting to spend more time with them." Rose apologized to Sharp and Workman for missing them in Springfield as he walked in Evergreen's front door, then made his way around the lunchroom, shaking hands with residents. Resident Frank Marshall said to Rose, "I hope we get a budget sometime." Rose replied, "You and me both. We made a step in the right direction this week." When Rose finished shaking hands, he addressed the lunchroom and spoke of a positive step. "I don't want to pat myself on the back because we have a long way to go, but last week you saw rank and file members of the state Senate and state House stand up and say, 'Enough's enough. We have to get something done,'" Rose said. Now that was a very small bill, but not the complete package. But it did help in the area of higher education, and what you're starting to see is people starting to cooperate and work together, which is long overdue. Marshall said he appreciated Rose's visit. "Some of us still vote, and we want to know what's going on," said the 93-year-old Marshall. "He was kind to come here and give us an opportunity to express ourselves. I'm encouraged." Making a tour of the facility, Rose spoke with Evergreen Administrative Service Coordinator Andrea Robinson. He asked how Medicaid payments have been going, and she told him they've sucked. They're 8 to 9 months behind, and we had to freeze raises. "But you've been receiving some of the money," Rose said to Robinson, who replied, "No, we haven't received anything." Rose shook his head and said, "That's why I do these tours. We're gaining ground with the human services piece. There has been some coming together, and thankfully human services has been brought along in the conversation. We're not there yet, but that conversation behind the scene is much farther along today than it was 3 weeks ago." Rose and Robinson also discussed other issues Evergreen has dealing with the state aid system. Stinger gave Robinson his card, and Rose told her to call any time she needed help. "The conversation I had with Robinson is way more impactful for me as far as finding out what's really going on between the Medicaid system and the facilities than it was talking to lobbyists or having a rushed conversation in Springfield. when there are 25 other things going on, Rose said, but I am sorry that I missed them. The next article, details of sex abuse could mean prison time for Hastert. When Dennis Hastert pleaded guilty last year to breaking banking laws, sentencing guidelines suggested that the former House Speaker would probably serve no more than 6 months in prison for making illegal withdrawals to cancel a dark secret from his past. But after prosecutors lifted a veil of secrecy from the case, the judge made comments that suggested he might impose a longer sentence, potentially putting Hastert behind bars for several years because of allegations that he molested at least 4 student athletes when he was a high school wrestling coach. Word that one of the accusers will speak at the sentencing hearing is sure to turn up the pressure on Judge Thomas M. Durkin to reject defense calls for probation and send the 74-year-old Republican to prison. If that happens, Hastert, who was second in line of succession to the presidency after the vice president and the nation's longest-serving GOP speaker, would become one of the highest-ranking politicians in American history ever to be incarcerated. Prosecutors have said they would have preferred to charge Hastert with a sex crime, but because the statute of limitations on sexual abuse ran out decades ago, they settled for banking violation. Hastert admitted evading financial regulations when he began withdrawing money to pay another victim $3.5 million to ensure his silence. Authorities have made it clear they intend to treat the sex abuse allegations, not the banking violations, as their focus at sentencing. Court practices generally allow discussion of a defendant's personal history and character, especially if some bad behavior is related to the crime. Punishments available to the judge range from probation and home confinement to a maximum of 5 years in prison. Until this month, it was hard to gauge what Durkin might be thinking, but at a recent hearing, he let his dismay show for the first time. The judge repeatedly singled out how Hastert, in a 2015 interview with federal agents, sought to deflect blame by falsely accusing Individual A of extorting him with a bogus sex abuse claim. That lie happened last year, the judge said, and unlike the abuse allegations, it was not distant history. The lie would factor into sentencing calculation, Durkin added. That's a big one. Hastert's plea deal set the sentencing range from 0 to 6 months in prison, but guidelines in federal court are just that. Judges have huge discretion, so Durkin could impose a prison term of more than a year or two. Now we will take a break from the Herald and Review, April 27th, and the reading will continue soon.